I've been listening to something about Revelation lately, and I know I'm not going to give a sermon on Revelation or the Mark of the Beast or anything, but I'm going to start off mentioning that. I got to get my clicker. Sorry, I forgot. In Revelation 14, it talks about this mark of the beast, and I got this picture here because some people think, you know, that there's as many ideas for what the mark of the beast is as there are people that are coming up with ideas, and that's fine. Another angel followed him, saying with a loud voice, "If anyone worships the beast and his image and receives a mark on his forehead or on his hand, he will also drink the wine of the wrath of God, which is mixed in full strength in the cup of his anger, and he will be tormented with fire and brimstone in the presence of the holy angels and in the presence of the Lamb." So we're talking about this mark, all right? And it says he's going to get a mark on the forehead and the hand. Now, my question is, what's this talking about? I don't know, and I'm not going to try to say there's any particular answer. Everybody's got an idea about what it could be. And there's, you know, I could have 50 or 100 slides on what it could be. But I don't know that it, you know, it's not the purpose of this sermon, and I don't know what it is, and I don't claim to know. But there's something I do know. It says, if anyone worships the beast in his image and receives a mark on his forehead or on his hand, he will also drink the wine of the wrath of God. So that's something that you don't want and I don't want. So we're going to put an X on that one, okay? And if we go to Revelation 20 and verse 4 later on in the book, it's a certain, you know, the vision there, there's these thrones, and they that sat on them, and judgment was given to them, and I saw the souls of those who had been beheaded because of their testimony. That's not a nice thing either, but because of the word of God. But these are loyal people, and they had not worshipped the beast or his image, and had not received the mark on their forehead and not on their hand. They came to life and reigned with Christ for 1,000 years. So I think that deserves a check. That's a category. Not that I want to lose my life, but I want to be in that category at least at the end of that verse. So I don't want to receive the mark on my forehead or on my hand of this beast, whatever that might be. Now I got a question for you. This is a painting from the 16th century of John, supposed, you know, having the vision and writing about it and so forth. John sees a vision, all right? We know that. He saw a vision. And, excuse me, later on, he recalls the vision and he writes it down. He writes some things down about it. He writes about it. How does he describe what he saw? Now, that's something we wonder about sometimes. He's, you know, it's a vision. You don't really know what, you know, necessarily what you're, but he describes it. He's got animals, he's got beasts, he's got all kinds of things that he remembers. But how does he make sense of it? Does he make sense of it? Well, I think he does. And so do lots of other people think that he does. And if he makes sense of it, what are his points of reference? Where does he get these ideas? Where did he get the perspective that he had? Any idea? Where, if you were John, you saw all this stuff. Where would you get any kind of a, like, what's going on here? Well, just go ahead.
Book of Daniel,
and a lot of other books in the Old Testament. It turns out that Revelation is the most not quoted because there's no exact quotes. But there's more references to the Old Testament in the book of Revelation than any other New Testament book. And that's just amazing. So he's got all kinds of points of reference if you look into it. And this is one of them. You know, where did he get it? Well, he got his understanding of what these symbols might have meant and the way he put it together and the way he explained it from his Bible. His Bible was what we call the Old Testament, and he was probably reading a Septuagint. If he had access to that, or he heard it in church or synagogues. And if you go back into what we call the Old Testament, and Exodus chapter 13, verse 9, for instance, says you serve, it's talking about these, the what we call phylacteries in modern English. It shall serve as a sign to you on your hand, all right, and on your forehead. You see that up there? That the law of the Lord may be in your mouth, for with a powerful hand the Lord brought you out of Egypt. So John had this already. You know, he knew this. He knew his Bible. And you come to Revelation and there's a mark on your hand, or your arm and your hand and on your forehead. It has to do with the law. It has to do with what God has said. All right? And in Deuteronomy 6, verses 6 to 9, These words which I'm commanding you today, they'll be on your heart. So it's not just, you know, is God impressed with the fact that you can take a little, some scripture, you know, write it on a little piece of paper, stick it in a box, and stick it on your forehead? What was the point of that? Well, obviously we know what the point of it is. It's to remind you, remind them, and if we were to do the same thing, it would be to remind us of what this, what's written on there, okay? The words which I'm commanding shall be on your heart, shall be inside of us. Teach them diligently. We know this verse about teaching them to our sons and daughters, and when we walk by the way, when we're in the house, lie down, when we rise up, and so forth. And they shall be as frontals on your forehead, and write them on the doorposts of your house and on your gates. In other words, it needs to be in our brains and in our hearts. And that was the point of it all. What is the point? The point is right there at the beginning. These words which I'm commanding you shall be on your heart. All right? So, and the book of Revelation is an interesting book, and I'm not talking about that today. It's just the introduction. But one way of looking at the book of Revelation without getting into all the details is, whose side are you on? It's really about whose side are you on. Are we on the side of, I've talked about chaos here before and the Tower of Babel and all of that. Are we on that side? Are we on the chaos side? Are we on the world side, the present evil world? Is that where we are? Is that where our loyalty and our, is that where our brains are? Or are we on God's side? Kingdom, okay? And the book of Revelation is all about that. You've got some people that are this way, and some people that are that way. And they have very different futures, if you want to put it that way, and very different end in the end. So it has to do with loyalty. It has to do with what's going on in our brains. And I've been talking, and this will be the last one of them, I've been talking about the things that we ought to be thinking about. And I thought, well, I'll tie that in with the book of Revelation because I've been studying about it lately. And we've already read. We've read Philippians 4, verses 8 and 9 every time. Finally, brethren, whatever is true, whatever is honorable, whatever is right, whatever is pure, whatever is lovely, whatever is of good repute, if there's any excellence and anything worthy of praise, dwell on these things. The things you have learned and received and heard and seen in me, practice these things. So it's not just having these things in our heart or in our brain, but we need to do these things, or the things that are consistent with the thoughts. And the God of peace will be with you. So we don't live in a peaceful world. And we've been talking about that before the service and during the service. The world is a mess. Sometimes it's closer to us. I mean, you might have friends that live in Israel, or they have relatives that live in Israel. So that seems a little bit closer to home. It's not close geographically, but it means it's more of a Western interest because there's the battles going on there now. But there's battles all over the world, and places that aren't as close to us in the West. And there's no peace, you know. Even when we say peace, there's no peace. But Philippians tells us that the God of peace will be with us, and is mentioned also in the verses before this, in 6 and 7. So we've talked about that. And you know, my point in bringing this up for the fifth, that's the fifth sermon now, I think, it'll be the last one, is that God makes promises to us if we have our minds full of these kinds of things rather than the chaos of the world around us. We get to choose. So we talked about whatever's true, all right? With truth being the true being a quality of someone, a moral character, a way of life that's opposed to the chaos of the world, the normal world citizen, and an understanding of what God's doing in the world. It can also mean real in the absolute sense. But these are things that are true, that have to do really, when you think about what's real, you're looking toward God, all right? Whatever's honorable, and I've got a picture of Queen Elizabeth, but you know, we're really talking about God, who's things that are humans can emulate our Creator in good ways. And you know, whatever's honorable, referring to an inner majesty or sanctity, dignity, and we talked about that, dignity, being worthy of respect. We talked about whatever's right, the word just meaning, you know, having to do with law, being in line with the law or justice in the King James. So it regards one's relationship to law, a lot of Psalms about that too. The law is the standard of measurement, and you know, that's how we're measured, that's how we ought to measure ourselves. We ought to understand the law so that we know. And then we talked about whatever's pure, use the idea of a bride, we're being a bride, be the bride of Christ, and that means something, and it means that we need to be pure, as a bride should be pure, not defiled, you know, clean, innocent, modest, chaste, holy, set apart, the hagios word that we looked at. Blameless, there's all kinds of adjectives you can use here. And these are adjectives that describe the bride of Jesus, the bride of Christ, that we are part of that bride. So we talk about whatever's true, whatever's honorable, whatever's right, whatever's pure. What's similar about all that? There's a lot of things that are similar. But one thing that's important, if you remember one thing, I know I gave different messages on each of these, but I want to tie them all together in one way. And that is, they have to do with our minds being focused on God. What's above, all right? Whatever's true, that has to do with God. God's the one who decides that. Whatever's honorable, whatever's right, he's the one with the law. Whatever's pure, being set apart for holy use. All those things have to do with God. So our minds, for these four points, have to be up, as if heaven's there. I don't know where God is. That's irrelevant because we live in a universe and he doesn't. But the point is that our minds need to be there, need to be with him. And that's what all of these have in common. But now there's two more that we're going to cover today. Two more. So if we read again, true, honorable, right, pure. Now we have whatever's lovely, whatever's of good repute. All right, or it could be different ways of translating that. But whatever's lovely, whatever's of good repute. That's what we're going to talk about today. Whatever's lovely and of good repute. These are things that we need to think about also. Also, so we'll take a few minutes and look into these words, these phrases, and see what they have to teach us. Whatever's lovely, lovely. All right, there's your Greek word. Anybody read Greek? There it is. We got the anglicization of it, or however you say that word. And it's prosphiles. All right, and that's the word that's translated lovely. Prosphiles. This word is used only one time in the New Testament, right there in Philippians 4, verse 8. It's used three times in the Septuagint. We'll look at those. But the root of this is the phile. Now, let's see if I can get my, if I can put, nah, I did that every time. Somewhere on here there's a thing. Anyway, I won't find it. Prosphiles, all right? See the P-H-I-L? We know that from Philadelphia, or we know that from philia in the Bible. It has to do with a love, right? With that, so that's in there. And that word, or forms of that word, are used several hundred times in the New Testament. So it's a very common word. But this particular one, prosphiles, the combination, is only used once. And what it means is dear to. All right, the pros means to, and the philes means loved. Okay. So dear to, or loved by, or however you want to put it, has to do with being dear to, and the implication is to someone, that you're beloved, lovable, gracious, it could be translated that way, pleasing or acceptable is another way it could be translated, agreeable, cheerful, could be translated that way. There's all these ways, none of those translations would be incorrect. They all are part of what this word means. Beloved is another way. It's another good translation. But it doesn't mean, when it says lovely, it doesn't mean the way we use it in our language as beautiful. Oh, what a love, It's more of a lovely in terms of what's going on inside of one, what someone's personality, if you want to call it that, or their behavior, their kindness, all these things that make them pleasing and acceptable and agreeable and beloved by others. So, the interesting thing there about this is that we're not talking about God. We're talking about relationships with each other. In other words, my behavior should be such that I am dear to you, lovable, gracious, pleasing to you, acceptable to you. That's asking a lot, for me, for you to treat me that way. But the point that Paul's making is that we all ought to be that way in relationship to each other, that we ought to live lives and behave in ways that make us beloved by others as well as God. So this word has more to do with how we relate to one another in our Christian walk. Prosphiles, okay? Prosphiles. again, it's used only once in the New Testament, but it is used three times in the Septuagint, so we'll just take a minute or two and look at them. Here's one in Syriac 4, verse 7. These are all from the Lexham English Septuagint translation. Make yourself beloved by the assembly and bow your head before the great. All right, so it's talking about humility is part of that, but make yourself beloved by the assembly. So that's part of the instruction in Syriac to whoever he was addressing. And I don't know enough about the book to know. But the point of bringing up the Septuagint is because if you're Paul and you're going to use a word, you're only going to use it once, and it's going to mean something to your audience, well, what's it mean? Well, yes, the word was used in regular Greek, but he's writing to either Jewish Christians or in some cases Gentiles, but the Bible that they had was what we call the Septuagint. It was a Greek translation of the Hebrew Scriptures. So if a word is used a certain way in the Septuagint, then it's a good chance, and it makes sense, that that's also the way that it's going to be used by the New Testament writers, because that's the Bible that they're familiar with. So this would be consistent. You know, it's not in the Bibles that we use, so we can, you know, maybe you could say, well, it's not necessarily canonized or inspired in that way, but it's the way the word was commonly used, and it was used in the church that way. Here's another one in the same book. The wise in word will make himself beloved, but the favors of stupid people, and other translations say foolish, but this one says stupid, will be poured out. The point is that we, as you know, believers, should be make ourselves beloved. We want to behave in ways that result in good relationships between people. And human beings are not known for that. That's why there's wars. I've told you before, I get to teach two of my grandchildren in homeschool, and I'm the history teacher. That's one of the things that I get to teach. And the books typically talk about, you know, ancient civilizations, and they're always fighting over something. So I really simplified it. I say, now they know the answer. I say, what are they fighting over? And it's power and money, typically. And that's never changed throughout history. And, you know, we started a long, long time ago, and now we're up to we've already gone through the Middle Ages, and this year we're up into semi-modern times, you know, 17th century or so, so far. And nothing's changed. There's still people fighting and killing one another to get stuff or money and power. And we're to be different than that. And, you know, that's a whole other subject, but, you know, Jesus said, we don't want to be like the world, like the chaos that's out there. We don't want to be motivated like them. And that doesn't make them, you know, they only know what they know. But we're called out of that. We're called out of the world system. And we're not to think like that. So anyway, it's different. This word is also used in the book of Esther, not the Esther that we know, but Esther in the Septuagint. And, the Esther we know is in there also. But in the Septuagint, is another book about Esther. And it says she was the blessing in the flower of her beauty, and her face was cheerful as to be beloved, but her heart was distressed from fear, talking about before, you know, what was going on in the book of Esther. But it's cheerful in other ways. Part of what's going on here is that we have a cheerful disposition, and that's hard. That's hard in an evil world. But how can we be cheerful when the world's a mess? Well, we're not part of the world. I mean, we say that, but is it real? Are we really not a part of the world? Well, how much do we invite the world into our brains and into our hearts? That's the whole point of this series of sermons. Is Paul says, think about these things. Don't think about the stuff that's out there. It's out there. You know, they were all Roman. Well, they weren't all citizens. You weren't necessarily a citizen in those days. Paul was a citizen, but the average Jew wasn't, at least not in Judea. And some of the Gentiles, of course, that he preached to were not citizens because they hadn't earned that, or their city hadn't earned that right, whatever it was. But you had the Caesars were in charge. Some of them were good, some of them were awful. Life, you could have a good governor, you could have a bad governor. You could have, you know, the particular military unit that's assigned to where you live might be abusive, they might not be. It's just, nothing's changed in thousands of years. You know, all you have to do is study history or read one book. Just pick a book out that's got some detail about history for the last, you know, 6,000 years or however many thousands of years we have recorded history. It's never changed. It's always been a bad place and a chaotic place. Prosphiles. I love, this is a Bible knowledge commentary. It's not my favorite commentary, but I loved the way they defined these two words. And they defined this lovely, or the gross phileis, as it's speaking of what promotes peace rather than conflict. Now that's really simple, but it's profound. And I'm terrible at that. You know, my brother, I give these messages while my brother's sitting in the audience, but I've always been one that can, I can find conflict when, even when there isn't some sometimes. Because I, you know, I make a big deal out of something. But that's not the way we're supposed to be. And, you know, we try to teach our children not to be in conflict with each other, or our grandchildren, in my case. But it's natural. This is the human nature is we don't promote and seek peace except on our own terms. We want, and if we don't get it on our terms, we tend to lean toward conflict. So I love this definition. I love this definition, and I got to learn from it. In the verses that came before Philippians 4 verse 8, and we've read these before, but be anxious for nothing, but in everything by prayer and supplication with thanksgiving, let your requests be made known to God, and the peace of God, which surpasses all comprehension or understanding, King James says, will guard your hearts and your minds in Christ Jesus. So the whole point of this, Paul's saying, is that it brings peace, an inner peace to us. And sometimes we don't have that. Sometimes we're going through trials, and he understands that. We're not going to really be at peace at those times. We go through traumatic events in our lives, and we're not really very much at peace then. But in the long run, if we are thinking about the right things and practicing the right behavior, God promises this peace to us. And that's in a world that is not peaceful. So that's a nice promise. Peace is the context of all of this. And we read this before, I think, in one of the messages, Isaiah 26:3, that the steadfast of mind you will keep in perfect peace. That's shalom, shalom, because he trusts in you. So we do need to trust God. And again, it's where's our mind? Our minds be focused in that direction. And then we live in a certain way that enables us to be at peace with our brothers and sisters. In Colossians 3, verses 12 to 15. So as those who have been chosen by God, holy and beloved, put on a heart of compassion, kindness, humility, gentleness, and patience. Now that doesn't describe me. At least I hope I'm getting better, but that's not my natural bearing. Bearing with one another and forgiving each other, whoever has a complaint against anyone, just as the Lord forgave you, so also should you. Beyond all these things, put on love, which is the perfect bond of unity. And let the peace of Christ rule in your hearts, to which indeed you were called in one body, and be thankful. So Paul is writing and pleading with the congregations that he's teaching and nurturing to be at peace with one another. And Christians in the last 2,000 years haven't been real good at that. And we think sometimes, you know, in our particular culture that we're called out of that. We're different. No, we're just as bad or worse. We fight over everything. I'm not talking about this, you know, this group here right in this room. That's not my point to pick on anybody. But just looking at it historically, we divide over everything. We're not at peace because we're not motivated by compassion, kindness, humility, gentleness, and patience all the time. You know, sometimes we have disagreement, but that doesn't mean we have to not be at peace. So it's a tough thing. But sometimes, at least in my where I have been, and areas that I've been, and people that I've associated with, we've looked down our nose at other people who call themselves Christian because, oh, they don't get this and they don't get that. And they would have the same right to, if there is a right, to look down their nose at us for being the same way and for not getting along and not practicing what we preach. So it's a message to all of us, this particular word, pros phileis. We need to be lovely. We need to be beloved. We need to be behaving in such a way that people will like us. If they don't like us for what we teach, that's fine. You know, and Jesus prophesied that. He said it's the way it's going to be. But it shouldn't be because of how we live and how we treat one another. One more, John 16:33, we read this at Passover in the evening usually. These things I've spoken to you, that in me you may have peace. In the world you will have tribulation, but take courage, I have overcome the world. So Jesus is saying, you know, through, we have a spirit. He left, but then he gives us a spirit, so we can have peace. He's still with us because he defeated the world. He defeated the world, the systems, the system, you want to call it. You know, Luke 4, Matthew 4 says that the devil offered him the world, right? Offered him the kingdoms. He said, you can have it now. You don't have to wait. You don't have to go through all the stuff that you're going to go through. I'm adding words here, but that's the understanding that we get. You know, the devil's offering an opportunity to take a shortcut and get that power from the devil, who apparently had the ability and the, you know, that he could give it. He could give it. And Jesus resisted that. Jesus said no. You know, and he conquered the world. And from then on, if not before, you know, those disloyal spirits had to obey Jesus and obey those that rebuked them in Jesus' name. So that was a big change. Jesus has overcome the world. And he's overcome the evil. So we need to be in tune with him so that we can be on that same page. Doesn't mean we won't suffer. Jesus suffered. He lost his life. But, you know, the reward is great, as the Bible teaches us. So we're Christians. We call ourselves Christians. We should be different. I think our Christians are supposed to be different. But we need to think about that. And the older I get, the more I think about this. Because in my youth and all my energy, I wasn't thinking along those lines. And I was willing to be not peaceable all too often. So I could learn. I learned from my past. I mean, you can learn from your past. We all learn. All right, so we've got one more phrase there that's kind of related. Whatever's of good repute. And this is euphemos. Now, we know that word, right? Like a euphemism. And because the word means, if you break it down, the EU, however, that means well. And the femme, okay, is a report, or the fame, or, you know, reputation is a good English word. So we have a good reputation is what this word has to tell us. Something that's good. And that's what you do with a euphemism, right? You take something that's not so nice and you butter it up and put a little coating, icing on it or something, so it doesn't sound so bad. So you try to turn something, or the euphemism tries to turn something that kind of sounds negative into something that sounds a little more positive, has a better repute, all right, a better fame. So that's that's why we know that word from euphemism. This isn't euphemism, this is just a good report, but you're familiar with the term. It means to be well spoken of. Well spoken of. Now, does that mean we got to go around and try to just please everybody and always just do everything so that we, you know, we're so insecure that we want always somebody to say we're great? That's not the point. But the point is that if we behave ourselves properly, if we follow God's laws and treat other people the way we should, we will be well spoken of. Maybe, again, maybe not for what we believe, that we follow Jesus. Did Jesus prophesy that, you know, that he suffered, that Christians would also suffer. But apart from that, we should be well spoken of because of how we treat people. Admirable is another way you could translate this. Whatever's good repute, whatever's admirable, what's worth admiring. And somebody say, yeah, he's, you know, he or she, good, you know, good in this way, good in that way. Praiseworthy could translate it that way too. Again, this is only used once in the New Testament, used right here in Philippians 4, verse 8. It also doesn't appear in the Septuagint at all. so it's this. Now, again, different forms of this, of the root, do appear in the Bible, but that particular phrase is only used by Paul in this one place. So this is another attribute before that has to do with how we relate to one another and how we view one another and how we're viewed by others. It's again not like the first four where it has to do with us and God. This has to do with us and each other. And it takes both. It takes both is what Paul's message here is, that it's not just about, because we can say, like Paul said, some of you say you're of Paul and some are Apollos and some are of Jesus and some whatever. You know, you have these things. You divide over all of this. So we can say, well, it's just you and me, God, and then we can be mean to everybody else. No, Paul says that you can't do that. You can't do that. It has to work both ways. We need to be able to get along with our neighbors, be good examples and so forth, and be thought well of by others. Not that that's what our goal is or our aim is, but our aim is to have that good behavior that will result in a good reputation. Excuse me. Again, the Bible Nods commentary, I like its way it describes this word. It says it relates to what is positive and constructive rather than negative and destructive. And again, I think we have a lot we could learn, and I'm not talking about anybody in particular, I'm just talking about our tradition. We've had different problems going back many years in our church culture, and we don't handle it very well. My wife and I were talking about that today, earlier. She's down in Columbia, by the way, if anybody didn't hear. She and Bonnie went down there. But we don't handle the differences very well. And instead of being positive and constructive, a lot of times we're negative and destructive. So we don't have that good repute. Paul, now in several instances, he's talking about eating meat sacrificed to idols, and he's saying it doesn't really matter. We don't know where the meat was. You don't really need to know. But he says, don't be offensive about it. Don't do something that's going to offend somebody else and bother their conscience. So he says, all things are lawful, but not all things are profitable. All things are lawful, but not all things edify. He doesn't mean all things are lawful in the sense that I can do anything, or there wouldn't be a point in having a law. Obviously, that doesn't make any sense, right? You have laws that tell you some things are not lawful. He's just saying, if something is lawful, doesn't mean it's necessarily profitable. Just because you are allowed to do something doesn't mean you can offend somebody else by doing it and you're guiltless. Paul's saying sometimes, not all things edify. Not all things build up. All right, so let no one seek his own good but that of his neighbor. So he says it here. He also says it in Romans 14. I think I have that. Yeah, Romans 14, verse 19. So he's talking about the same subject. Don't offend people who would be offended by if they know that meat has been sacrificed to an idol before it showed up in the shops, if that would offend them, then don't eat meat in front of them. Don't offend them, because that person's more important than whether or not you get some meat. And meat was a big deal then, as opposed to now. So he says that. So then we pursue the things which make for peace and the building up of one another. That's the same word. Edify just means building up. Okay. So we ought to be, as Christians, in the business of building up one another instead of cutting each other down. And really building up people in general. I mean, there are things that go on in the world that are not good, and we all agree with that. We all know there's all kinds of problems. And what do we do about that? Well, we can tear down the people that we don't like, or we can build up, or we just ignore it. That stuff's out there. I don't know that I talk about it in the rest of this sermon, but I'll just say it now. I see in our culture, in our church culture, I'm talking about the churches I grew up in and I've been in most all of my life, and churches that are not the ones I've been in, same thing in America, that they're becoming more and more political. We bring politics, we bring typical dissatisfaction with whatever's going on in the world or in our own country or our government or whatever. We bring that into church and make it an issue here. It shouldn't be. That's the chaos of the world that we need to leave out in the world. So whatever's of good repute, what's positive and constructive, edify. The word edify is an interesting word. When you see that in the Bible, and it's in there a bunch, the root word is doma. I didn't give you the whole word, but the root of edify is D-O-M-A, which means a dome. This means you build something, right? And so we should be building. We should be building. That should be a positive thing. You and I should be building. Building up, okay? Strengthen is another way you can translate that word. It's translated edify. Build up or strengthen. So what I need to think about is, what's my effect on the congregation? And I don't mean just like when I give a sermon. I worry about that a lot. But how about when I'm not giving a sermon? When we're just sitting around talking or whatever. What's my effect? Am I positive and constructive? Or am I negative and destructive? Right, it's one or the other. That's the Metrodome in Minneapolis that was there back in the 70s, I guess it was. That's the Metrodome after 1982, when they had a big bad snowstorm and it collapsed. So we either are building or we're destroying. Okay, I just picked a dome as an example since the word has to do with dome. And I have to admit that a lot of times in my life, this has been the result of how I've interacted with somebody instead of this. That happens in my own house more frequently than anywhere else, all right? And we learn, right? We learn to be more positive. In Acts 9:31, this is after Paul was called on the way to Damascus, and then he started, he's busy, he's preaching. He wants to preach right away, and they say, settle down a little bit, you know. But after they got him settled down, and people got to where they trusted him a little bit, because they didn't trust him at first, it says there in verse 31 of Acts chapter 9 that the church throughout all Judea, that's down here, Jerusalem's, where is it right here? Throughout all Judea and Galilee and Samaria is in between. So the church spread, especially after a little bit of persecution, the church spread over that area. And it says that it enjoyed peace, being built up and going on in the fear of the Lord and in the comfort of the Holy Spirit. And it continued to increase. So there's an example for us that if we want to have an impact and have people come to God and come to his son, then we need to be at peace. We need to be building one another up. And that if we don't, then at least this verse would imply that we're not going to have the same success. Ephesians 4, verse 29. Let no unwholesome word proceed from your mouth, but only such a word that's good for edification. All right, you got to edify again. Only that word, only that's a word that's good for edification according to the need of the moment, so that it will give grace to those who hear. And again, I'm picking on myself more than anybody. This is not, I think of my parents, especially my mom, if she were around and heard me say this, it would warm her heart because, you know, I didn't grow up that way. I didn't grow up always thinking, saying nice things. And sometimes, you know, I didn't mean to be mean, I guess, but I was. And so finally, in my old age, I'm starting to learn a little bit. And next time I see her, hopefully she'll be able to tell that. But we all need to learn that. Not to have unwholesome words proceed from our mouth, but words that are good for edification. Building up, building, you know, like building a wall here. And give grace to those who hear. And that's something we can all learn. So whatever's lovely, beloved, pleasing, okay, whatever's of good repute, admirable, and edifying, all right, these are things that have to do with us dealing with one another and building up, helping one another. And that's easier said than done. And just because we say we think that and we want to act that way, we don't always do it. And it's something I think we can all do better. I know I can. So we have that, but then we also have the ones that we've talked about before that have to do with our relationship with God and what we have in our mind, where that comes from, whatever's true, whatever's honorable, whatever's right, whatever's pure. And now we add to that whatever's lovely, whatever's of good repute. And then it says, I'm not going to have a whole separate sermon, but it's kind of a summary comment. Paul says, if there's any excellence and anything worthy of praise, dwell on these things. So it's kind of a summary of all six that we've gone through. These are things that are excellent and worthy of praise. He says, think about these things. Think about these things. And then practice the things you have learned and received and heard and seen in me. Practice these things, and the God of peace will be with us. So we read that. So one thing I haven't talked about at all, I'm going to wrap up with this. At first I titled this, maybe even with the first time I spoke here, I titled it Dwell on These Things because that's the way the New American Standard translated it. And then as Brad, yeah, I did. I did have Dwell because Brad said, that's a title you put on the first one. And then I changed it to Think. Why? Because I think most of us are more familiar with the King James. And so when we think of this verse, we think of Think on These Things. So I thought, well, I better do that so people know what I'm talking about. But what does it mean, think? You know, we know what think means in English. We understand that. Just spend a minute or two here looking at that word in Greek and what it means to us. You know, what does it mean to dwell on these things? Think on these things, all right? That's one of Rodin's thinkers. I used to think when I was in college in Baltimore that the one there was the only one, but there's a whole bunch of them. I don't know how many there are. But there was one at the Baltimore Museum of Art right next to the college I went to. This isn't that one. This is out somewhere else. A thinker. Did he look like he's thinking? I guess. Apparently it was a thing to think in the nude. So that worked. So here's the word. And you can look at that. You can look at the English transliteration there. That word, if you want to know how to, I don't know why it's M. I don't see an M in there, but the pronunciation that the program said is lomisomai, lomisomai, not logisomai, lomisomai. And you can see, if you look at that word, what do you see in there? The L-O-G-I. It has something to do with thinking, but it's not any kind of thinking, is it?
Logic.
Something that's maybe logical, reasonable. All right, that's implied in there. It's implied in the word. Now, it means, yes, it means not just thinking, but a reasonable thinking, to reason. Another way that word is used, and it's in the Bible all kinds of times, that root, is to reckon or count, you know, like you're an accountant, all right? It has to do with keeping accurate tabs on something. It's not just whatever you're thinking about works for this word. No, it's a thinking where you really are thinking and you're making sense of it, and you're figuring out what things mean and all. It's an active thinking, a proactive thinking, I guess you could say. It also can mean to deliberate or to conclude. So those are the ways that words use. And this is my definition. I was trying to read all these definitions and none of them really did it for me. So I thought, think with purpose. Think with purpose. Not just think, because your mind can wander all over the place, right? Think with purpose. Know what you're doing when you think. That's what Paul's saying. He said, I want these things to be on your mind. And if they are, you will experience peace. The peace of God will be with you. Think with a purpose. The purpose is that you want to be in tune with, in sync with, like we say now, God and his way of thinking. So if we think logically and reason, then we're thinking with the intent of action. What are we going to do? All right, so that it's not just a list. It is a list of things to think about, but these thoughts being in our hearts and minds will then motivate us to certain types of action. And the things you have learned, the things you've received and heard and seen, practice these things that you've seen in me, Paul said, and the God of peace will be with you. So it has to do with action, too. It has to do with action. So it's not just thinking. It's thinking with purpose, and with a purpose to directing our lives in a certain direction. So, Mark of the Beast, you can think what you want to think about that. I don't really care one way or the other, but I think when John was writing that, John was thinking about what was going on between your ears. And whether or not we would have God's law in there, in our foreheads, and on our arms. Now, what's the point of that? One is, what's the symbolism there? The one on your forehead is what? What's the symbolism of that phylactery on your forehead? It's what we think about, right? What's the one on your arm? What you do. All right, that's the obvious symbolism. And everybody understands that. So, it has to do with both. It's thinking and acting. So think purposefully. Purposefully. And I would suggest that we as Christians in a modern, very divided world, more often would think about which side we're on. And I say, well, am I questioning which side you're on? No. It's just that in our day-to-day lives, we get wrapped up in the stuff that's around us. And sometimes we drag it into church too. You know, which side are we on? Are we on this? Are we on the Babel side? The side of the beasts that came up out of the sea and all that? The chaos? That's the present evil world that we're part of, that we live in. But we don't need to be part of it, you know, in our minds. We just have to live here. We have to make a living somehow or another. And we do. But we don't need to bring that kind of thinking, the thinking of the, you know, why did Daniel and then John use the symbolism of beasts coming up out of the sea? You ever think about that? I didn't think about it. I think I knew why they used beasts, but why they come up out of the sea? Well, the sea is a symbol of chaos. Some years ago, I spoke about that here. So we got the, you know, they got the sea monsters. You got all this stuff, and these beasts come up out of the sea. They're part of the chaos, right? So that's what we have. We have world governments that operate like animals, like carnivorous animals. That's just the way it is. Nothing's changed from Daniel's time till now. Some might be worse than others, but they're all part of the same system. So is that the part? Is that what's going on in your brain and my brain? I hope not. Or is it, you know, the restoration of Eden, the kingdom of God? Well, that's where our minds need to be. We know that. Seek first the kingdom of God and his righteousness, and all these things will be added. So it is important whose side we're on. And that ought to be reflected in the things that we think about. There's chaos in the world, and it's all around us. It's all around us. Let's keep it there. Let's keep that chaos out there. Don't invite it in. Don't invite it into your brain or your you know, the brains of the people around you. Keep it out. Keep it out and think about whatever's true, whatever's honorable, whatever's right, whatever's pure, whatever's lovely, and whatever is of good repute. Think on these things.